When the delegates to the Second Continental Congress converged upon Philadelphia in May of 1775, the atmosphere within the brick walls of the Pennsylvania State House was radically altered from the tentative, petitioning spirit that had characterized their first gathering the previous autumn. The political landscape of British North America had undergone a tectonic shift during the intervening months, shattered by the echo of musket fire along the rustic road between Concord and Lexington just 3 weeks prior. No longer were these men assembling merely to debate the constitutional nuances of imperial taxation or to orchestrate non-importation agreements designed to pinch the pockets of London merchants. The blood spilled in the Massachusetts countryside had effectively closed the chapter on peaceful protest, thrusting a body of lawyers, merchants, and planters into the uncharted territory of de facto sovereignty. As the humid spring air settled over the Delaware Valley, the representatives of 12 distinct colonies found themselves suspended between two worlds, still professing an unyielding loyalty to the British Crown while simultaneously confronting the terrifying necessity of managing an active, expanding armed rebellion against that very same sovereign power. The crisis of the late 18th century had arrived at their doorstep, demanding an unprecedented level of political sophistication, institutional improvisation, and raw physical courage from an assembly that possessed no constitutional mandate, no treasury, and no established executive authority to enforce its will. The physical setting of their deliberations offered a stark reminder of the immense weight bearing down on each man who crossed the threshold of the assembly room. The Pennsylvania State House, with its elegant Georgian architecture, became the crucible where regional identities were painfully forged into a fragile continental coalition. Upon convening on May 10, the immediate business of the Congress reflected both continuity and abrupt transformation, as Peyton Randolph was initially re-elected to the presidency, only to be called back to Virginia shortly thereafter to tend to his duties in the House of Burgesses. In his stead, the delegates chose John Hancock of Massachusetts, a merchant prince whose immense wealth was matched only by the notoriety he had achieved as a primary target of British ministerial wrath. Hancock's ascension to the president's chair was a deeply symbolic gesture, signaling to the world that the Congress would not abandon New England in its hour of peril, even as the wealthy smuggler philanthropist took his seat with the knowledge that a royal bounty hung over his head. The early sessions were characterized by a chaotic influx of correspondence from provincial congresses and local committees of safety, each dispatch bearing frantic intelligence of troop movements, supply shortages, and the systematic breakdown of royal governance across the seaboard, forcing the delegates to realize that the luxury of abstract philosophical debate had been irrevocably stripped away by the march of military events. Within this charged environment, the Massachusetts delegation operated with a calculated intensity, acutely aware that their province was already under martial law and that the city of Boston had been transformed into an occupied fortress. John Adams and his cousin Samuel Adams formed the intellectual and organizational engine of this New England radicalism, working tirelessly behind the scenes to convince their more conservative colleagues that reconciliation was a fading mirage. John Adams, with his sharp legal mind and sometimes abrasive temperament, recognized earlier than most that the structural bonds of the British Empire were fraying beyond repair, yet he understood that any premature push for independence would alienate the vital support of the wealthy middle colonies and the agrarian South. Samuel Adams, a master of political mobilization and grassroots organization, complemented his cousin's legalistic approach by subtly channeling the outrage of the New England populace into the halls of Congress, ensuring that the raw, democratic fervor of the Boston town meetings hovered constantly over the colonial assembly like an invisible, radical specter. Together, they navigated the deep currents of regional suspicion, knowing that many Southern delegates viewed New Englanders as dangerous, leveling Republicans whose religious zealotry and democratic excesses posed as much of a threat to traditional social hierarchies as the policies of the British Parliament itself.